Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Lynn Wilson welcomes Dr. Aaron Hofsatter. Dr. Hofsatter is assistant professor of medicine and medical oncology at Yale School of Medicine, and she joins us this evening for a conversation about high-risk genetics and breast cancer. Here's Lynn Wilson.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about what is high-risk genetics.
Well, high-risk genetics is a field of medical oncology. My specific interest is in breast oncology, that really identifies people who are at higher risk for developing cancer over their lifetimes.
Tell us a little bit about your own background, your training, specialized training in this area. Tell our listeners.
Sure. Well, I actually grew up here in Connecticut. After I went to Amherst College, I attended medical school here at University of Connecticut. I went to Boston for a few years, completed my training there, most recently my fellowship at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And now, in a way, I've come back home to Connecticut and have recently started at Yale Cancer Center as a breast oncologist. My specific interests in medical oncology started in medical school, I would say, during the classes I took as a second-year student. And those interests really were confirmed over the years as I saw more patients, and really it confirmed my interest in pursuing a career treating patients with cancer. During my fellowship, my hematology-oncology fellowship, I enjoyed my interactions with all of the patients that I saw, but really was drawn to those patients who were treating for breast cancer. You know, I like the field. I most emotionally connected with those patients with breast cancer. So I think that was where that interest was developed. And then specifically, my interest in genetics came from largely a clinical rotation I did with one of my mentors, Dr. Nadine Tung at Beth Israel, as well as some of the research projects that I did both with Dr. Tung as well as Dr. Gerberg Wolf there at Beth Israel.
So. And how did you develop the expertise in genetics? Was it obviously, it sounds like the interest started there, but did you do additional coursework or research, or sort of how did that come about? How do you get to the point where you have expertise in something that's sort of a subspecialization of a subspecialization already?
Absolutely. Well, a lot of that was clinically developed. There, unfortunately, short of doing an additional genetics fellowship, there's not a lot of formal training in high-risk genetics. Once I identified this interest, a lot of this was gathered during my clinical training. I was in a medical oncology fellowship, so I was able to focus on that during my fellowship in terms of clinical rotations, research projects, a lot of reading, a lot of rotating with different folks.
Yeah, I was going to say, so it sort of sounds like you've got enough responsibility during your standard training program, but to develop this additional expertise, you did a lot of extra work.
Yes.
On the side at the same time.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Fine. So tell our listeners a little bit about some of the genetic mutations you're interested in, concerned about, or that you look for in a patient with breast cancer.
Absolutely. Well, let me start by saying that most breast cancer is not genetic. In fact, about 75% of breast cancers happen just because they happen. There aren't any identifiable risk factors. There's not an identifiable family history. They just happen. And again, that's about 75% of breast cancers. Only about 10% of all breast cancers can be attributed to an inherited gene. In terms of those 10% of breast cancers, only about half of that 10%, only about 5% of breast cancers overall can be attributed to two specific genes, namely BRCA1 and BRCA2. Those are the two gene mutations that are most commonly associated with breast cancer, and again, account for only about 5% of all breast cancers that are diagnosed each year.
So although that's a small percentage, I take it that one of the reasons we try to identify the patients who have these genetic linkages is because this may have some sort of impact on their therapy, for example?
Not specifically for those women diagnosed with breast cancer, there is research going on right now for specific medications, namely PARP inhibitors. It is a specific chemotherapy that's being studied for use in those women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer who also carry a gene mutation. One of the things that's important about identifying when a cancer is related to a gene mutation is to potentially it affects a woman's choices about her surgical options for the treatment of her breast cancer, but it also impacts other cancer risks. For example, when a woman inherits a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, not only is it she at increased risk for breast cancer, but she's also at increased risk for ovarian cancer as well. More specifically, when a woman inherits a gene mutation, a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, her lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is upwards of 85%. And in terms of ovarian cancer, her lifetime risk is upwards of 40%. So these risks are high. So certainly we take that information into consideration for treatment of her breast cancer, but we also think about, again, ovarian cancer as well.
Are there other factors that would lead you to feel that a patient may be at high risk to develop a breast cancer or one of these other cancers, for example, or are we just talking about BRCA1 and 2, or are there other factors that you add into the determination of what constitutes high risk?
Absolutely. Certainly, the genetic mutations are the most concerning in terms of risk of developing a breast cancer. But there are other groups of high-risk women. For example, if a woman has received radiation therapy to her chest, perhaps for a Hodgkin's disease in the past, something like that. Other women who might be at high risk include those who have been diagnosed on surgical biopsy with a high-risk feature, specifically atypical ductal hyperplasia, for example, or what's called LCIS, or lobular carcinoma in situ. These are diagnoses that would, again, we wouldn't know about unless a woman underwent a breast biopsy for another reason, perhaps something found on a mammogram or whatnot. And then lastly, you could argue that there is women who have a strong family history of breast cancer but have not been found to have a gene mutation also are at increased risk of breast cancer. Certainly family histories with multiple generations affected by breast cancer, young breast cancers, these are red flags for either a gene mutation that we can identify or perhaps not identify. We do feel strongly that there are a number of genes out there that can be passed along that we just aren't smart enough to identify quite yet.
What sort of recommendations do you have for a patient who has a strong family history, for example? Say there's a patient who seems fine right now, not having any problems, but has a sister who had breast cancer, a mother, and a grandmother who had breast cancer. What are some of the guidelines in terms of risk assessment, genetic testing, what age, and what groups of patients should be considered for this?
That's a great question. It's an important question to answer. Let me begin by saying the most informative person in a family to test for a gene mutation would be the person who's affected with cancer themselves. That would be the most informative results that you can get. That would certainly tell you whether or not that person's cancer could potentially be related to, a BRCA1 or 2 mutation or another gene mutation that we could look for. In terms of red flags, sometimes it's not possible to test the person with cancer. So family histories would include certainly if there's a known mutation in the family, but otherwise breast cancers that are diagnosed at a young age, 45 or younger, certainly should be considered for testing. Certainly if there are multiple breast cancers in the family, particularly if one of those breast cancers is at age 50 or younger. Certainly if you're looking at multiple generations or multiple people within a generation that are affected, that would be a red flag. Ovarian cancer in the family at any age, particularly if it's in combination with breast cancer, a big red flag for a consideration of genetic testing. Male breast cancer in the family is a red flag. And there's particular populations of people who are at higher risk of carrying a mutation, specifically those who are of Ashkenazi Jewish ethnicity. In the general U.S. population, the frequency of having a gene mutation, a BRCA1 or 2 gene mutation, is about 1 in 400 people. However, in the Ashkenazi Jewish population, that frequency is about 1 in 40. So automatically, those folks are at higher risk for carrying a gene mutation. And so therefore, for example, if you're of Ashkenazi Jewish heritage and you have a breast cancer, you should be tested.
How do we actually do the test?
That's a good question. It's a blood test that's done. It's not that easy. Often Well, the recommendations are that folks obtain this test at the referral of their doctor to a cancer genetic counselor. And we've got a terrific program here at Yale run by Ellen Matloff for specifically cancer genetic counseling. So oftentimes patients either call on their own because they're concerned or more often are referred by a doctor for counseling. And during that counseling, the counselors are able to sit with the patient and go through their family history in great detail, assess what their risk is, whether or not a genetic test is, if it's indicated to send, if the risk is high enough to go ahead and send the test. And then the patient returns for their results so they can discuss in detail the implications of the results, how to interpret the results, because like any test, there's positives, negatives, and gray.
It's complicated. It's not like coming in and just getting a blood count and the doctor tells you it's normal and you're all set to go after that.
Exactly. And what's concerning is that there are increasing commercials and marketing for folks to send off a cheek swab, if you will. You know, basically you take a Q-tip and swab the inside of your mouth and mail it off to the company to tell you what your DNA test shows. And that's concerning to us because sometimes, like I just mentioned, the results can be difficult to interpret. So our concern is that, you know, when folks undergo genetic counseling without genetic testing without specific counseling, that errors can occur.
Yeah, and so, I'm sure in some cases there may be some results that perhaps are considered abnormal, which a patient could get a lot of anxiety about, mm-hmm. but explained through the professional may not be as concerning as one might think just by looking at a piece of paper.
Absolutely.
So this is important. Mm-hmm. Tell us, we've talked about your expertise and interest in genetics. Tell us a little bit more about your active role in the breast cancer program, what your week is like, for example.
That's a fair question. I would say that my role within the breast cancer program is threefold. I mean, primarily I'm there to provide clinical care to the patients, both for women who are affected with breast cancer, as well as those women who are at high risk of developing breast cancer but do not yet have the disease. A component of my job is involvement with clinical research, and I also provide medical education to medical students, residents, fellows.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
What are some of the challenges that you faced working with women who've not been diagnosed with breast cancer, but you think may be at risk based on some of the things you've already discussed with us?
Yeah. I would say the biggest challenge really is dealing with the uncertainty of whether or not these particular patients are going to go on to develop the disease. On the one hand, you want to do as much as you can to prevent the cancer from occurring, but certainly not at the cost of causing potential side effects or causing a person to go through a significant procedure when you're not even sure, definitely, that a cancer is going to develop. And quite frankly, these are otherwise healthy people who don't have cancer. So it really is a balance between trying to be as aggressive as you can and not causing any unnecessary side effects or potentially even harm.
How do you do that? Do you see them on a more frequent clinical basis? Is there certain testing you recommend? What would be different for the patient in follow-up who is at high risk compared to a patient who's not at high risk, who might be seeing a physician once a year for a general evaluation, mm-hmm. and perhaps get an annual mammogram, hopefully, for example? What's different about the high-risk patient in terms of what they may have to go through as far as what you would recommend?
That's a good question. One of the things that we would recommend is more frequent breast exams. So a clinical exam every 6 months is usually standard of care for folks at high risk. So either the folks are coming to me to follow them for high-risk surveillance, or this can be completed by the person's primary care physician or their gynecologist, so long as a physician is examining them every 6 months. Certainly annual mammogram plays a big role in surveillance, but another question would be, what could the role be for potentially breast ultrasound or more specifically breast MRI for these women? There is a certain group of high-risk women, those who are felt to have a greater than 20% lifetime risk of developing breast cancer, that would qualify for an annual breast MRI. So for many of my patients, I'm following them both with annual mammogram as well as annual breast MRI.
Well, we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about high-risk genetics with Dr. Aaron Hofstadter.
The American Cancer Society estimates that last year there were over 65,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and over 1,000 patients are diagnosed annually in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. And new treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention, as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by Dr. Aaron Hofstadter, and we're discussing high-risk genetics and breast cancer. So, Aaron, before the break, you talked a little bit about the clinical follow-up program for patients who might be or have been identified as being at high risk. You mentioned mammogram. Talk to our listeners about what a mammogram does, what's involved, and some of the other procedures such as ultrasound, MRI, and these diagnostic tests.
Mm-hmm. So there were three that I mentioned earlier in terms of standard breast imaging to screen for breast cancers. I think the one that most people are familiar with is the annual mammogram that women undergo, usually starting at age 40 and onwards. I think many of the women in the audience are familiar with mammogram, where there is basically x-rays, special x-rays taken of the breast when the breast is compressed so that the best possible imaging can be obtained. Now, mammogram is very good at picking up cancers, and the studies, if you've been paying any attention to the news, there's been a lot of news about mammogram and whether it's good or whether it should be done in young women or not. I think we as breast oncologists do continue to recommend that mammograms start at age 40 and continue annually from there. Obviously, this needs to be discussed with a woman's doctor, but as of right now, that is consistent with the American Cancer Society's recommendations, and that's what I would advocate for.
For someone who's not at high risk?
For someone who, I would say for the average American woman, I would recommend starting at age 40. Certainly women who are at higher risk should start at an earlier age, potentially even as early as 30. And as I mentioned, mammogram is very good at picking up breast cancers, but can't pick up all breast cancers. And that's where we start looking for other imaging, such as ultrasound or potentially breast MRI. Many women who are receiving their mammogram reports now in the state of Connecticut are receiving information about the possibility of dense breast tissue. On the bottom of many of the mammogram reports, there's a statement that you may have dense breast tissue. You should talk with your doctor about considering ultrasound. Now, the reason for that is because mammogram is essentially an x-ray. Now, dense breast tissue shows up as white on the mammogram. However, cancer shows up as white on the mammogram, so it's very difficult to pick out a white cancer on the background of white breast tissue. So that's basically what that means when there's a statement about dense breast tissue, is that the woman's mammogram may not be as effective as picking up a breast cancer. That's when we start thinking about using either breast ultrasound or breast MRI to look for these breast cancers. Now, ultrasound is an easy, painless procedure where it's basically a handheld probe. You put a little gel on the woman's skin and you hold the probe over the skin and you examine the breast for any other additional findings. And oftentimes this works well in conjunction with mammogram of picking up other lesions that the mammogram might miss. But what's better for adjunct screening really is breast MRI. This is a very sensitive radiographic technique to find breast cancers. Oftentimes the woman is lying on her stomach and the breast is imaged. The MRI does take longer than a mammogram does, though I'm told it is not as uncomfortable potentially as a mammogram. The difficulty with breast MRI, however, is that it's very, very sensitive, which on the one hand is good because it will pick up many more breast cancers. The downside is that it's very, very sensitive, so you have a much higher chance of having a false positive result with breast MRI. this could potentially lead to increased anxiety on the part of the woman who's told that her breast MRI is abnormal. It could potentially lead to biopsy, and that can become a problem, particularly if a woman has a breast MRI that continues to have false positives or often finding a lot of abnormalities. So again, the sensitivity of the breast MRI can be a double-edged sword sometimes.
I see. So you talked a little bit about the real importance of counseling for patients who not only are at high risk, but anybody really getting a genetic-based test. The counseling is a key feature of
Absolutely.
This to interpret the results, whether they are abnormal or normal. Are there other things that are offered to women who are at high risk, such as clinical trials? Are there research investigations going on so that we can learn more about patients who are at high risk?
Absolutely. I'd say that the area of research within breast cancer treatment, breast cancer prevention, breast cancer genetics is abundant. Specifically in terms of the gene mutations, as I mentioned, the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene mutations are the most commonly known, but there's a lot that we still don't understand even about those gene mutations. For example, we don't exactly understand why they appear to behave differently in different people, even within the same family. For example, if one woman has inherited a BRCA2 mutation, she may develop breast cancer at age 40, whereas someone else in her family with the same exact mutation may develop breast cancer at age 60. We still don't fully understand why these mutations behave differently in different people. So that's one area of research. Another important area of research is the search for additional genes that we haven't discovered yet. Very often in my clinic, I see patients with an extremely strong family history of both breast and ovarian cancer, but they tested negative for BRCA1 and 2 gene mutations. So it's clear to me that there is a gene running through their family. I just can't tell them which one. So that too is an area of research.
I see. So we're trying to learn more about the genes we know about. We're still trying to figure out what causes these mutations.
Absolutely.
And we're trying to learn as much as we can. Obviously, it's complicated and multifactorial, and there could be a whole array of other genes out there. There for sure is. We just don't know what they are yet.
There is. There is. In fact, another interesting area of research is that we know that there are a number of what's considered low-risk breast cancer genes out there. When you inherit any one of these, in fact, they're quite common in the population, one of these low-risk gene mutations really doesn't in and of itself cause breast cancer. But if you start inheriting 5 of these, 10 of these, 20 of these low-risk genes, we're starting to wonder if potentially a combination of some of these low-risk genes may translate to an outcome of breast cancer. So that's another important area of research that's being pursued right now as well.
Now, we all have genes as part of our genetic makeup. Explain to our listeners what is meant by mutation. What is that?
Yes. A mutation is basically an abnormality in the DNA. And I'm glad you asked that question. We've talked a lot about BRCA1 and BRCA2 and looking for these genes. In fact, we all have these genes. Everybody has BRCA1 genes and everybody has BRCA2 genes. It's when these genes are mutated or are incorrect, if you will, broken, if you will, is when problems begin. When a person inherits a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, they're basically inheriting a broken copy of these genes. Now, these genes are important in the normal person because they work to repair DNA. And many people are surprised to know that DNA gets broken all the time. But we have been designed to repair the DNA naturally. However, when somebody inherits a broken copy of BRCA1 or BRCA2, fortunately, they have a backup copy that can work to repair the DNA. Unfortunately, in many of these folks who inherit a mutation, that second copy or the backup copy breaks as well. And that's what causes the setup for cancer, is when you have two broken copies of these DNA repair genes.
I see. So if we have a woman who has these mutations, what sort of things can you speak to her about regarding reduction of her risk going forward in terms of trials, medications, surgical procedures? Talk to the listeners about what's available. We do the counseling. We've got the information. The patient understands what's going on. What can we do proactively moving forward to help reduce risk of a bad outcome?
There are three main areas that I talk to my patients about in terms of reducing their risk of breast cancer. The first is really what surgical options does the patient have? And what I'm specifically talking about there is whether or not a woman should consider undergoing a double mastectomy, or basically removal of the breast tissue on both sides. This is a very effective way of reducing the risk of breast cancer. In fact, there have been studies that show in women who are mutation carriers, gene mutation carriers, they can reduce their risk of developing breast cancer by 90% or more. We can't do anything to make the risk zero, but certainly prophylactic mastectomies or removal of the breast is the most effective way to prevent breast cancer from happening in the first place. Usually this is an extreme. It's the most aggressive thing that you can do to prevent breast cancer. And I would say most times the women considering this procedure are those women with an identified gene mutation, or perhaps those women with LCIS or lobular carcinoma in situ. But it remains an option for other women who, again, appear to have a very, very strong family history of breast cancer. So that would be, in terms of reduction of breast cancer, something to consider. I also mentioned earlier the possibility of removal of the ovaries in women who are BRCA1 or 2 gene mutation carriers, because again, this translates to a risk of developing ovarian cancer as well. By removing their ovaries, not only does that reduce their risk of ovarian cancer, but actually if it's done in a premenopausal woman, a woman who is still menstruating, it can actually reduce her risk of breast cancer as well. So that the benefit is twofold there. So,
and surgery. Is that because of the changes in the hormonal makeup of the body?
Yep. Okay. It is. It's basically taking away a substantial amount of the woman's estrogen in her body, and it's felt that elevated levels of estrogen are related to the development of breast cancer. So surgery is certainly something I talk about with women. The second sort of area that I talk about with women is there a medication that they can use to prevent or lower their risk of breast cancer? And there are two that are FDA approved, specifically tamoxifen and raloxifene, otherwise known as Evista. Of the two, tamoxifen, I would say, is the better known. Evista is an osteoporosis medication that, in hindsight, they found also prevented breast cancer. However, these medications, while effective, they can reduce the risk of breast cancer by approximately half. They do have side effects, and that's where you have to start weighing the pros and cons of using these medications. The good thing is that they do help your bones and they prevent breast cancer, but the downside is that they do have side effects such as hot flashes, night sweats, risk of blood clots, risk of stroke, and tamoxifen additionally has a very small risk of causing uterine cancer. So certainly when you're considering using these medications in otherwise healthy people who don't yet have breast cancer and may never have breast cancer, you have to, again, begin to weigh the pros and cons of how much risk is there of breast cancer versus how much risk is there of the side effects.
With tamoxifen, for example, when that's used therapeutically for a woman who's had a diagnosis mm-hmm. of breast cancer and has been treated, we typically recommend tamoxifen for, say, 5 years.
Yes.
Is the recommendation for someone who's at high risk where we're using tamoxifen, is it known how long we should use that medication for? Do the same types of rules apply, or do we not really know?
That's a good question. The studies that have been done comparing tamoxifen to placebo, or basically a sugar pill, and the studies that have been done comparing tamoxifen directly with Evista, both used regimens that were one pill a day for 5 years, similar to how tamoxifen is used for breast cancer. And it's also been proven that the protective effects of using these medications last even beyond the 5 years that they're taken. Tamoxifen in particular, the 10-year follow-up data shows that protective effect lasts at least 10 years, if not longer. We'll continue to get this data as time goes on.
Tell us a little bit about what you see will be developing in your program in the future.
Well, we will be opening up a number of clinical trials here at Yale in the coming years, specifically looking at different markers for breast cancer risk, looking at a diabetes medication, specifically metformin, as a potential risk reduction agent in women at high risk of breast cancer, as well as some other medications that we've identified for folks who have been diagnosed with things such as atypical ductal hyperplasia, other specific high-risk women. I would say, globally, there's great potential for research going forward, specifically for chemo prevention, surgical prevention, and a better understanding of the genes. I think long term, the hope is that by once we have a better understanding of what genes are causing the breast cancer and how these genes may be playing out in each individual, we'll be able to tailor our prevention strategies for these women so that we can effectively prevent breast cancer from happening in the first place.
Dr. Aaron Hofsatter is Assistant Professor of Medicine and Medical Oncology at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.